From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Starting today, we're broadcasting live from ETV in Columbia, South Carolina. The Democratic primary is just days away, and the state is blanketed with politicians and the celebrities who've endorsed them. Nearly half of the voters expected to go to the polls on Saturday are likely to be African Americans. But is this primary a test of racial loyalty, or for black women, a tug of war between gender and race? Well, yesterday we went to the historically African-American Benedict College here in Columbia. In addition to students both decided and undecided, we also found two actors stumping for Senator Barack Obama.
And without further ado, Chris Tucker and Kerry Washington.
I'm happy to be here, but I want to give yourselves a round of applause for showing up, being concerned. And go out to vote for Barack Obama, right? Who you with?
I think that what our job is as young people, what your job is as young people, is to make politics sexy. I'm not kidding. I'm going to say sexy in a church. Because this is really important.
We got a chance to catch up with Kerry Washington after the event. She's appeared in movies including The Fantastic Four, and she shared with us that her choice to endorse Senator Obama did not come easily.
It's been a really tough decision for me, you know, because I'm a feminist. I consider myself a feminist. I always will be. And I kept feeling like, well, who do I owe my loyalty more? You know, is it Hillary? Is it Barack? You know, where should my allegiance be? And then I had to really step back and go, this is not about identity. This is about values and principles and, you know, a track record, a belief system. I mean, and I don't mean a religious belief system. I mean a political belief system. And, you know, that to me, that made me turn toward Barack Obama, because I feel like if I put all race and gender aside, who's actually able to lead us all of us as a nation, who I think is best for me and my nation?
Preston Simmons is in his junior year at Benedict, and he's undecided. The communications major agrees that race and gender should not determine who you vote for.
I'm not one to really go make decisions on race or gender, because I think it's pretty biased and I think it's ignorant, to be quite honest with you. If you make an important decision, especially when it comes down to our country, on race or on gender, it's ignorant.
Preston is clear about what motivates him to vote.
The major issues that are important to me, I have to say, it's health care, for one. The two candidates that I am choosing from, they do have good health care plans, but unfortunately one does leave a lot of people out of health care, and the other does promise to make it free, but I don't think that's possible, to be quite honest with you. And another one would be education as well. When I can say that, I mean money. As far as student loans go, everybody wants to make these loans, the interest rate lower or none, but hopefully they'll make that happen. Somebody will soon.
Ashley Brown is a political science major. She plans to vote for Barack Obama and believes that most of the Benedict College students also support the senator from Illinois.
On Benedict campus, there are more students that's leaning towards Barack than Hillary, because the students here are so passionate about Barack. They go to our dorm room doors, knock, inform us about Barack. I mean, we have really strong supporters of Barack that's on Benedict campus. Barack, I believe he's bringing out the young generation, because out of all of them, I believe he is more with our generation than anybody else. He can relate to the young generation more than anybody else.
And Tynesha Williams is a chemistry major and another undecided voter. For her, the issue is experience.
I would vote for Hillary because she has more experience and she's been around the White House for so long. And Senator Obama, he kind of scares me because he hasn't had as much experience, but he seems like a politician that I could relate to. So that's why I'm kind of leaning towards him, but not exactly sure.
Some of the students we spoke with said they won't make up their minds until they get in the voting booth. Tomorrow we'll talk to more college students about the issues motivating them to the polls. But today we've got a closer look at the lay of the land from a local perspective. Here to give us on-the-ground analysis, we've got Todd Shaw. He's a professor of political science and African American studies at the University of South Carolina. Also, Cynthia Pryor Hardy, host of the radio talk show On Point with Cynthia. Todd, Cynthia, welcome. Oh.
Thank you.
Hello.
Farai. Thanks for having us.
Good, yeah, it's nice to meet you in the flesh, Cynthia.
Yes, I was delighted to be with you last Friday.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the feel here in South Carolina. The primary's 3 days away. candidates have been campaigning since the Nevada caucus ended. Todd, is the excitement still building here?
Oh, yeah, very much so. And you can see it sort of palpable. I mean, I think in various settings across the community, people are coming out. They're excited. They're debating. You know, they're thinking really hard about this decision that they're about to make.
Cynthia, what about geography? This state is, you know, people talk about New Hampshire, mm-hmm. one of the earliest primary, and it's pretty small. Politicians can hop around. This is a big state. So how does geography play into who goes where?
Well, it's been interesting because we've got four major hubs, the Florence PD area. Then, of course, we've got the upstate area where Greenville is. And then we've got the Lowcountry with Charleston and here with us in the Midlands. And folks have been everywhere. I was down in Myrtle Beach for the Democratic presidential debate the other night. And we had a real cross-section of people who were there. And it was you'd be hard-pressed to talk to anybody who had not had the candidates visit their area. And that's been pretty good, you know, to see folks realize that what they have to do is to really get out there and get out there among our 3.5 or so million people here in South Carolina.
Todd, there are a whole lot of visitors here. There's a lot of celebrities, a lot of people who have come from other states. Later on, we're going to be hearing from a blogger who came all the way from the top of the East Coast to try to come here and see what was happening for herself. So how does it feel here in terms of communications, it's particularly from celebrities? Do people buy into the messaging, local folks buy into the messaging that they're getting from outsiders?
I think, well, the South Carolinians are able to kind of filter some of the celebrity out, certainly. But they're also quite aware that the celebrity helps draw their attention to certain things. I know, you know, there's been much a buzz about Oprah Winfrey and that rally that she held on behalf of Barack Obama, you know, a little while ago and drew 29,000 people. So I think they're aware that the celebrity is out there trying to grab their attention in certain ways. But I think some of it is helping to focus attention in ways that would be difficult otherwise.
Cynthia, what about the issue of identity politics? We just heard about our visit to Benedict College, and Kerry Washington, popular actress, was saying, well, I thought about being a feminist, I thought about being African-American, but ultimately it was the issues. She chose Barack Obama. How are people, including you, processing the whole issue of the variety of demographic choices that people have in this Democratic season?
I think that it's interesting. First of all, it's interesting that we have so many choices, that we can take a look at the candidates and see where we see ourselves. I think that's exactly what we have to do, though. I think we have to look at a candidate and see where we see our own ideological slant. And it's there where we should cast our vote. It isn't whether the person shares your ethnicity or whether they share your gender. It's do they share the same value system? It's one of the things that the actress Kerry Washington said in the interview before. You know, do they share the same value system that we share? And if they do, then that means they're more closely, they're more likely to act in a way that I would have my commander-in-chief to act. And so I'm hoping that as people feel the pressure, and there is pressure, I mean, the Clinton campaign is campaigning strong, the Obama campaign is campaigning strong, and even the Edwards campaign, they've, you know, kicked it up a notch. And so there's a lot of pressure on voters to make a decision. And so as we make that decision, I would hope that people wouldn't take the easy way out, which is to say, let me vote for him because I want to see a brother get in, or let me vote for her because I want to see a sister get in. But do these individuals share ideologically what I believe in and the direction that I would like to see my country go?
Todd, do you get a sense that Hillary Clinton has backed off from really competing as hard as she could in South Carolina?
I've heard some of that, and certainly some shifts in her schedule sort of suggest that. I don't think in any public way, but certainly because Bill Clinton's presence is still here, that's an admission. But, you know, I share with Cynthia, and on the reverse side of this coin, I would hope that that's not the case. I think a better strategy for the Clinton campaign would be, we're not conceding any ground. And the African-American vote is critical to us, critical to the Democratic Party, critical to this country. So I would hope they didn't give that impression if, in fact, that is actually the case. But I hear this from impressions.
Cynthia, you were at the debate in Myrtle Beach, and Senator Obama made particular mention of his faith, saying, "I am a proud Christian." He talks about trying to rein in evangelicals to the Democratic Party. Let's listen.
As somebody who believes deeply in the precepts of Jesus Christ, particularly treating the least of these in a way that he would, that it is important for us to not concede that ground, because I think we can go after those folks and get them.
Cynthia, do you think that this is pandering to Black Christian voters, insulating himself against some of the occasional slings that his middle name is Hussein, or just good politics?
I think it's good politics. You know, I listened to him. I was talking to a family friend the other day who also went to Harvard, and she shared with me that, you know, a number of young law school graduates come out of Harvard intending to go back into the community and to do good. But when the final analysis happens, somehow financial gain reigns out above the desire to do good. In the case of Barack Obama, he went back. He did work with those small churches. He did do those things. And so because of that, it appears that what he's talking about is something that he has lived and not something that he espouses to be. So in that case, if he's done it and it actually is a part of what he can claim, then I think it's good politics.
Todd?
Yeah, I think it clearly plays into sort of it could play into this broader sense about how are the Democrats trying to reclaim the mantle or some sense of connection between religiosity, one's faith, and politics in a careful way. And I think Barack Obama knows that he is hitting the right buttons here in the South, not to be derisive, but here in the Bible Belt. That is critically important in the African-American community. The church connection and one's faith is critically important.
Well, I want to thank both of you so much. It's great to have you here, to be here in South Carolina.
Well, welcome. Thank you.
And welcome to South Carolina. It's
yes,
great
ma'am.
To see you in our state.
That's
absolutely.
Right. It is.
We've been speaking with Todd Shaw, a political science and African American studies professor at the University of South Carolina, and Cynthia Pryor Hardy, host of the radio talk show On Point with Cynthia. Now we've got a couple of bloggers who are staking out their turf in South Carolina. Danielle Holly Walker blogs at scblackpress.com. She's also an assistant professor of law at the University of South Carolina. And Arlene Fenton is from blackwomenvote.com. She came to South Carolina to capture the action. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you. Welcome to South Carolina.
Oh, I'm delighted. So, Danielle, your blog is pretty new. Tell me why SC Black Press was started.
Well, looking around the blogosphere, there are almost no blogs that are devoted to African Americans and African American politics, especially here in the South. So there are a lot of us, especially those of us who are supporters of Senator Obama, who said, okay, this is a great time to start a blog, and a lot of people are newly engaged in the political process. So we saw his campaign as kind of a transformative political movement and one that could really up engagement in the political process in general among African Americans. So we hope to keep it going after the primary and after the presidential election, because we think that this is a kind of fundamental time and shift in political participation by African Americans here in the South.
So what are some of the issues that you think are the most important ones?
Well, you know, we blog a lot about kind of the politics of the day. So our blog was completely, you know, inundated with posts and also comments about Senator Clinton's comments about Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson for about a week. And we also did a whole segment on talking about myths related to Obama's candidacy for the presidency. So kind of a truth squad idea with talking about, is he electable, other rumors and myths about his candidacy, taking down myths from the emails that were going around about Senator Obama. So we did that. And also, we actually talk about issues. So we compared the health care plans of all three candidates and also talked a lot about education policy, kind of the issues that our readers are most concerned with.
Well, you know, this is something very interesting. Arlene, you actually came down to the state. This is not your state, but you decided to come down. Tell me why you came and specifically what blackwomenvote.com is.
I came because of all of the media attention on black women. My blog is, as you mentioned, entitled Black Women Vote. And it actually came out from another blog called What About Our Daughters? It's a very popular blog and kind of a watering hole in the blogosphere for black women and our supporters. In December, I wrote a post, which was an open letter to Barack Obama, in which I challenged him to address the specific issues of black women instead of hoping that we would vote for him out of a sense of racial loyalty and pride. The response to that was just record-breaking for our blog, and that's when we realized that we needed to have a unique space that talked about political issues for black women.
Now, what's your agenda for this trip? What are you going to do in terms of, are you going out and talking to people? Are you going to rallies? What's your specific agenda?
Actually, both. I've been meeting with various organizations. Essentially, the blog is not intended to promote any particular candidate, but to raise the level of political maturity for black women. I wrote a post called Stop Looking for a Messiah When an Army is What You Really Need. And essentially, black women need to create a strategic plan which would work regardless of who is president. And with that, we decided we're going to start meeting with different organizations, sororities, et cetera, for black women and to start to work on what would happen after the presidency, no matter who's elected.
Now, let me go back to you, Danielle. There is, let's put it this way, a lot of debate, including right here on our show, about black women, voters, do they go for the black man or the white woman? There is a third of the population for the Democratic vote that will be expected to be African-American women. But there's also another flavor. The third contender leading the Democratic pack is John Edwards, who is a white male. And as he has pointed out, tongue-in-cheek, and his wife has pointed out, that may not be the most popular flavor right now. But is there any love for John Edwards here in South Carolina?
There's a lot of love for John Edwards in South Carolina because he talks about the issues of poverty and ending poverty, which, of course, to many black voters and black women voters is really hitting at their heartstrings. I mean, we believe that he's a person truly committed to that cause. So I think there is a lot of love for him. I think the question for Edwards here is just that if the race has really come down to nationally Clinton and Obama, I think people are kind of hesitant to say, I have a lot of love for him. I think I heard that a lot after the debate. But will I actually vote for him knowing that the nominee is likely going to be either Clinton or Obama and wanting to make a difference in that choice? So.
Now, what about economic issues? What do you think, living here in the state, are some of the economic issues or social issues that black women are thinking about?
I think one of the key, and I think it's both an economic and social issue, is the issue of education. And a lot of talk about the corridor of shame on I-95 and just the idea that South Carolina and schools in South Carolina, especially schools that are devoted to educating poor black children, are lagging so far behind, and really looking for a presidential candidate who is really out in front on the issue of education, because obviously education is a huge building block for all economic health issues in the state. So I think that is a lot of what I've heard from a lot of people, and what there's been a lot of response to on our blog is discussion about education as really a building block to economic security.
Arlene, your site, blackwomenvote.com, has seen a spike in traffic. I mean, it is the election year, and it sounds like you're really out there on the road trying to get the message out. When you think about the issues that are affecting women nationally, black women nationally, what things come to your mind?
The first one is the AIDS crisis. It's the number one killer of young black women. The second issue is essentially homicide, although we really don't get that kind of attention. When people think about black-on-black crime, they usually think of young black men who are dying, and they are. But it is also the second leading killer of black girls between the ages of 15 and 24. So I think those two issues have been sorely neglected in this process, and that's something that we've been exploring on our site.
For both of you, I'm sure you're well aware that there are so many people who don't vote, that there could be twice as many voters in the presidential elections as there are. And What do you draw from that, Arlene, first, in terms of, do you see the candidates reaching out to try to get some of not only the swing voters, but the non-voters?
I think Barack has, to a certain extent, and I think he's actually succeeded. I think one of the big problems is they're not addressing the right issues for those groups. Don't vote because they don't hear anyone talking about their problems. A lot of these people, they don't watch the Dow Jones. You know, I mean, they want to know, how am I going to pay for my education? I'm struggling with my student loans. They're not really hearing those things being talked about. And I also think that most of these voters, even the young ones, are more savvy than these politicians are giving them credit for. They aren't going to vote for someone just because they're black or just because they're a woman. And also, I'm seeing a growth of people who are saying, maybe it's a mistake for us to only be looking at Democratic politicians. So I think at this point, it's time to look at that group with new eyes and be a little more specific about what their issues are.
Danielle, what about, I mean, because everywhere, period, there are people who don't vote, but it's really linked to socioeconomics and education. Those are the two top things. If you're poor, you're less likely to vote. If you're not educated, you're less likely to vote. Is anyone building bridges?
Absolutely. I think that one of the most exciting things about the Democratic primary on Saturday is to see if the candidates were really effective in getting new voters out to vote. I think that the turnout in New Hampshire and also in Iowa showed that people are really energized by this process. I agree with Arlene that I think that Obama's camp has been doing a lot to get people involved, including having huge voter registration drives on student campuses. So, you know, we have a lot of HBCUs here in the state, South Carolina State, Claflin, Benedict Allen. And I think on those campuses, there was a lot of voter disengagement. And they went specifically to the people and said, okay, here's why you need to register for vote. And I think Arlene's also right that, you know, it's not just about voter registration drives, but also about hitting issues that people who don't traditionally vote are concerned with. So creating jobs, student loans, predatory lending, those are the kind of issues that engage non-voters, traditional non-voters.
Do either of you have any concerns about things like the voter ID laws or any issues with the polling places? Do you think I'm going to go to you first, Danielle. Do you have any concerns about perhaps how many polling places there are, whether or not they can handle capacity?
Yeah, I think there's a big concern about that. This is the first year in South Carolina where the elections are not being run by the Democratic Party. They're being run by the Election Commission. And we saw that resources are split up because the Republicans already had their primary last Saturday. We're having Democratic primary this Saturday. So there's a lot of concern that there won't be enough polling stations and also polling machines, voting machines to meet the demand. But I do think there's being a lot done. So I know that Obama and both Clinton have voter protection efforts that are out there trying to answer questions about ID. And Congress passed the Help America Vote Act. And that also has created a lot of confusion and issues about voter ID. So people just should know what's required. Go and look before you go out to vote at what's required to actually cast your vote. And there will be people on site to really help resolve a lot of these issues.
Arlene, whether you want to take it local or national, what about these questions of access?
On a national level, I have extreme concerns about electronic voting. I'm a systems engineer by trade. I know how many things can go wrong, and I've actually taken a look at the code from some of the states, and it's horrific. It's full of mistakes, and it's very easy to crack. So I don't see the fail-safes that are being put into those systems, something physical that can prove vote by vote what that person voted for. So that would be my number one concern.
Now, when people say their vote doesn't count, and I'm going to back into this, what do you say? Now, a little background. We talked to students at Benedict College, and one young man told us he wasn't planning to vote because in his mind his vote didn't matter. Arlene, how do you motivate people who specifically have said, you know what, it's not that I'm not even voting because people aren't reaching out to me. I specifically think this does not work.
I think what I would do is point at the legislation that other people have gotten. It's really, you know, a problem of them not being educated as to how the system works and what is happening against them. A lot of them don't really feel a sense of urgency because they don't know what the stakes are right now with Brown versus Board of Education coming into play. A lot of those students aren't really aware of what the problem is with that. So essentially, I think the answer is educating them more on the political process.
Now, Danielle, what about race? We have been talking about a lot of substantive issues, but there was so much fighting between the Obama and Clinton camps. Has that quieted down? Are people really talking about the issues now?
I think people are talking about the issues, but I do think that there is a chance that that this could really have long-lasting effects on the Democratic Party, and I think we're seeing that start to happen. I think that the back and forth between not just Obama and Clinton, but their supporters and their surrogates, people like Bob Johnson and people like that, I think that that could really have a lasting effect on the Democratic Party. And also, honestly, I think the media is really hyping up this issue of race and the racial divide that could potentially happen in the primary. And I think also with the issue of Latinos and all of this reporting suggesting from the mainstream media that there's no way that Obama can capture Latino voters, all of that is kind of adding to the hype of this big racial divide in the primary season. And I think that it could be really damaging for the Democratic Party if there isn't some way to really dial back, because I think people are thinking about the issues. The media is reporting it as a racial story. All of the black voters and white voters that I'm talking to here in South Carolina are talking a lot more about the issues than they are about the racial aspects, potential racial aspects of the primary.
Well, Arlene and Danielle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Arlene Fenton of the blog BlackWomenVote.com and Danielle Holly Walker, who blogs at scblackpress.com. We've just been speaking with two of the bloggers here in South Carolina. We also have our own team at News and Notes. Do you want to volunteer for a campaign but don't have the time? Now you can volunteer for your chosen candidate and never leave your couch. Our own team includes web producer Jeffrey Bennett for News and Notes. He's here to explain. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So we are preparing for Saturday's vote. How are the candidates using the web?
Well, like you said, they've made it possible for folks to do some heavy lifting on the part of the campaigns without ever leaving home, really. Both Clinton and Edwards on their websites have tools that allow people to register online to become volunteer phone callers. So if you have a computer, once you're approved, you get a list of your neighbors who you can call, and you get a script to follow so you can drop support for people, for those candidates among the people who live around you. And both Obama and Edwards let people sign up via cell phone for campaign updates and event information. And Obama even has what he calls a letter to the editor tool. On his site, they encourage people to write a letter to this local South Carolina newspaper, and they offer talking points for people to stay on message. And I should mention that this is in addition to, you know, photos, blogs, and videos that have become rather conventional on these kind of websites.
So we've got some of the folks from News and Notes here in South Carolina. What can folks find out on our site?
Well, on our blog, we've got a whole host of resources. We have links to South Carolina history and the role that that state played in the fight for civil rights, background and history on the Gullah people. We have links to all the candidates' South Carolina-focused websites and political analysis outlining the role the state has played in previous elections and what's at stake in this one. And if folks sign up for our newsletter, they can also get alerts as breaking election news warrants.
All right. What else is popping off on the blog?
Well, politics as always, but aside from politics, last week we talked about the ethical debate over consuming meat and milk from cloned animals. We talked about that on the blog and then followed it up on the show. Moji Odorinde, one of our readers, read that and posted, "Americans would rather eat products than real food." And she said, even if cloned meat were safe, she'd still want to have the choice. People are also talking about real estate, specifically pegged to the high-rise condo crash in Miami that you wrote about. Mel G., one of our readers who lives in Atlanta, read that and wrote, "The foreclosure rate in Atlanta is off the meter," and suggested that it prove the need to teach financial literacy in America's schools. And there's this issue about our show, is News and Notes Too Black? It was a post that you wrote sometime last week. And Don B. wrote, "Prove you're not racist, News and Notes. Where are the Latino, Asian, and white versions of your show? Ernie says she likes the balance that she gets from News and Notes, and someone even said we're too politically correct, so you can't please all the people all the time.
You never can. Jeffrey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. He joined me from our studios at NPR West. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We've been checking in live from South Carolina on the politics of the state with a key Democratic primary just days away. But there's also plenty of other news about the Republican race for the White House and the wranglings on Capitol Hill. For more, we've got Mary Frances Berry, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. Hi, folks.
Hello.
Hello. Hi. All right.
So let's check in on this Republican race. You have former Republican Senator Fred Thompson of Law and Order and the Hunt for Red October and our federal government dropping out. So, Robert, Thompson didn't do well in the early primaries, and then Mike Huckabee all but blamed him for sucking valuable voters away in the Republican South Carolina primary. So first off, why didn't voters warm to Thompson?
Well, the Hunt for Red October turned out to be a lot easier than the Hunt for Delegates. Senator Thompson turned out to be a case of the person who you simply loved and adored until he actually had to start running, and he ended up with a very kind of a laid back, laconic style. That didn't click even with the Southern, even with many of the Southern voters who should have been his target, audience. What ended up happening is, though, by staying in as long as he did in South Carolina, he ended up giving a very nice bump to Senator John McCain, who most people believe that may not be immediate, but eventually Thompson will probably endorse McCain. Already a number of Thompson supporters, such as former Senator Al D'Amato here in New York, have switched from Thompson to McCain, and that is probably going to be the long-term impact of the Thompson campaign. Helping John McCain at a late portion of the process to get an extra boost.
Mary, one thing that many of us noticed was that in the Democratic debate, there were references to John McCain as if he were already the Republican nominee.
Absolutely.
Why do you think so?
Well, first I want to tell you that I'm most proud of two things, predictions I made that came true, and I made them on this show. One was that John McCain would come back and be ahead when he was left for dead, and everybody laughed at me. And the other was when Fred Thompson started running, I said, I'm from Tennessee, and nobody in Tennessee can figure out how Fred has enough energy to run for anything. And therefore, I don't understand why he's running, and he's not going to get anywhere because he's too lazy. We know that. We love him, but he's lazy. So it turned out that we knew that from the beginning. As for McCain, I think that the same thing was happening in the debate the other night that was happening early on in the Republican debates when they kept referring to Hillary Clinton as somebody they could beat. You know, they kept doing that over and over and over and over again. They finally stopped for a while. And so now that McCain is back and now that the, quote, surge is supposedly working, depending on who you believe, they now think that, you know, McCain is going to do it. They don't take Huckabee all that seriously, and I think they should, actually. And now I really think that most of them agree with Robert that Thompson is likely to endorse McCain if he endorses anybody. But I'm not sure he has enough energy to endorse anybody. So those of us Tennesseans will be waiting around to see if he ever does that either, too.
Yeah, well, I think the Huckabee boomlet has hit its peak, and I don't think it's going to be going anywhere else. I mean, on one level, he is sort of the most charismatic person running in the Republican primary. However, if he couldn't win South Carolina with all of the evangelical votes there, I don't really see him finding some really opportune places to win afterwards. There are already stories that he's getting ready to pull out of Florida, which would, in a sense, cede the ground there Mitt Romney, McCain, and Rudy Giuliani, who's making that his last stand as well. So I'm not sure if Huckabee can really go so far as to basically, you know, to win it with the remaining states coming up.
Well, you're right that good old Senator Thompson kept him from winning in South Carolina, because I think he would have gotten those Thompson votes, and now maybe he can't get a momentum. And if that's true, then it's going to be whether Romney can stop McCain. Otherwise, he's going to go all the way to the nomination.
Well, yeah, it is. Sorry,
let me actually jump in and talk a little bit about the military, because it seems like both of you are saying that one reason Senator McCain is able to step in is because he had stood fast about the war. He'd criticized the president over issues of torture, but he'd stood fast in support of this war. And I want to mention that the Senate passed a new defense bill yesterday. It includes pay raises for military officials, mm-hmm. better treatment of military veterans. So there was a bill that was vetoed by the president in December of last year. It was pretty similar. Why the change, Mary, between then and now?
It was because the bill last time had some language that Senator Lautenberg, I think, from New Jersey, is very concerned about, and others, about people who have been harmed by the Iraqi government under the Saddam Hussein regime being able to have claims, soldiers and citizens who suffered under the former regime, to make claims. And the Bush administration and the Iraqi government, the new Iraqi government, didn't want that language in. They thought it would be a burden on the existing government, a financial burden. And so Bush said that he would veto it. He did. I mean, he said he didn't accept it because it had the wrong had this language in it. So now what the Senate did is they gave in. Congress, as they've done on almost, you know, they have to do that. They have to keep doing that because they don't have any votes to do anything else. And so they gave in and said, well, the State Department would try to work out something to address these claims. And so the bill passed cleanly. I mean, it was like, you know, like 40-some votes against it in the House, and maybe 9 or 10 or something like that in the Senate, maybe less than that. So it was not the details of the bill or the pay raise or anything else. It was just that issue of claims made for suffering that had taken place under the old regime.
Right. It came down to a legalistic slash possible litigation issue that the administration didn't feel that the current Iraqi administration should, in a sense, suffer from a litigation standpoint for the crimes of Saddam Hussein. So,
Robert, do you think that in his own way the president has wrestled the Democrats to the ground on war spending?
Oh yeah, absolutely. As Mary said, I mean, to get something passed in Washington these days, you need at minimum 60 votes in the Senate, and you need something, particularly when it comes to something critical such as war spending, you need a veto-proof margin, and the Democrats obviously don't have anything close to that. So when it comes to something like waging war, war funding, things like that, something that is a presidential prerogative, a presidential priority, if you will, he has the whip hand, if you will, and the Democrats were able to, you know, screamed and yelled about it, but ultimately they didn't want to be put in the position of saying that we're not funding the war, we're not supporting
all
the
right.
troops.
And it's also
we're going to have
case.
To wrap it up there, Mary. Sorry about
oh, okay.
that.
Well, more
Robert
next
and,
time, huh?
Absolutely. There's always the next time.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, Farai.
Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, spoke to us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., and Robert George is associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. He joined us from NPR's bureau in New York. Away from South Carolina's frantic politicking, there lie quiet communities on the seaside of the state. It's an area where some roads remain unpaved, women sell their hand-woven baskets, and people have a language all their own. These people are the Gullah, descendants of slaves who have developed their own distinct culture. Here to tell us more about the history, traditions, and language of the Gullah people is Emery Campbell. He's a fourth-generation Gullah family member and runs Gullah Heritage Trail Tours in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Farah. Glad
so,
to be here.
Emery, let's find out a little bit more about where you started and your family. You grew up in Hilton Head, and a lot of folks know it now as a resort town, but I'm sure it's changed a lot. What do you remember from your childhood?
Oh, I remember Hilton Head when there were only about 1,500 people at most living here. I grew up here in the 40s and 50s, and I tell folks that I thought everybody in the world was Gullah except Dick and Jane.
So what does Gullah mean to you? What does it mean in terms of how you speak, how you dress, how you tell stories? Tell us what it means on the inside to be a part of Gullah culture.
Well, to be a part of Gullah culture meant that you pretty much knew who you were. We still do know who we are. And by that, I mean everything that we saw when we grew up, Gullah people produced it. They produce our own food. We produce our own stories because we told them to one another. And made our boats, gathered our own food, had our own spiritual life because we had little praise houses in every neighborhood. And the leaders of those praise houses were Gullah family members. And family was very important because families lived close together. To us, Gullah was a world to itself.
There's a sense that the Gullah people have retained a lot of West African traditions. What do you see in Gullah culture that you identify as having roots in Africa?
I think the closeness of the family is the most visible sign of Africa here now, because we live close to the land and we are very, very connected family-wise. And the other thing is our food ways. We always liked rice. We grew it for a short period of time, but we always bought rice as a staple. And along with the African crops that we grew, like okra and sweet potatoes and sugarcane and watermelon, we can relate that to West Africa.
A lot of us associate rice with Asian foods, but in fact, some of the cultivation techniques that were used here in America are ones that you can trace to Africa. What do you think people need to know about the ways that Gullah families have kept tradition alive that's important to all Americans?
Well, I think people need to know that the Gullah tradition has sustained African Americans. African Americans are rooted in the Gullah culture through their spiritual life, through family and child rearing, the extended family where it took a village to raise a child. I think people need to know that all of that is rooted in the Gullah culture. People need to understand that Gullah people have a history of contribution to America, including the development of the rice fields, the labor that was put into the economy here. At the start of the Civil War, people need to know that the South, where most Gullah people have lived and contributed, had some 80% of the national gross product was right here in the South contributed by West Africans.
When you think about the things that are going on now that have to do with Gullah families not being able to afford some of the property taxes on their own lands, land being sold to developers and condos or resorts going up, are we seeing the end of the Gullah culture? If not, what will allow the culture to keep on going?
Well, it's frightening to watch how the culture is being overtaken by wealth. And strangely enough, some Gullah people have the thoughts that, by getting rid of the land, they can become wealthy too. But that has not been the case as we have watched over the last 20 years. And so we have a little hope in the Gullah Heritage Corridor that was established back in 2005, 2006, where we have a commission that's looking at how we can preserve those aspects of the Gullah culture that can contribute to the sustenance of the culture. We haven't had a meeting yet, but the 15-member commission is going to be meeting soon, and hopefully on a regular basis, to work with local governments on how we could save or preserve the Gullah culture.
So what do you do when you take people on your heritage tours? If I were to come over to you and ask to take one of your tours, what would you show me?
First, we'd be delighted if you did. But what we do, we go through 10 neighborhoods that were the only neighborhoods here before development. And so we have a good view of what was before resort development. And we explain life, as I just explained to you, how Gullah people lived before, as we said, before the bridge. But these neighborhoods are actual witnesses to history and the history of the culture. So we point out all of these intricacies of these neighborhoods to our visitors and give them a lesson on the Gullah culture.
Now, I understand that there was a translation of the New Testament into Gullah. Were you involved with that?
Yes, we got involved in that some 25 years ago, and it took us about 25 years to get it done. We met monthly, and we met like biweekly, and just phonetically translated every word in the New Testament to Gullah.
Can you read something for us, a short passage?
Why don't I read just the first few verses of the Lord's Prayer that most people are familiar with?
That would be wonderful.
And we say, pray like Disha say, be Father what day in heaven. Let everybody honor your name. We pray that soon your Gwan rule over the world. Whatsoever thing you want, let them be so in this world, same like they in heaven. Give we the food what we need this day and every day. Forgive we for we sin, same like we forgive them people what do bad to we. Let we don't have hard tests when Satan try we. Keep me from evil.
Well, Emery Campbell, it's been a delight to talk to you. Take care.
Same here. Thank you for that.
We've been speaking with longtime Gullah community activist Emery Campbell.
And the rooster crows, see now. And the rooster crows, see now. And again, the night, see now.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music.
Upon a broken guitar.